From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from U.S. Senate candidates Democrat Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger Eric Hovde about why they think they're the right candidate for the job.
Wisconsin gains mightily by my experience and by my seniority just because of that position. And I could say the same about my other roles. I do think there's something very strong to be said about both experience and seniority.
I bring a wealth of expertise from being in the real world, the private sector, and I want to go serve the country I love. And that's why I'm in this race.
Plus, this week we're exploring North Avenue and how the people who live and work along that stretch of road could influence the results of the presidential election. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. WUWM has been reaching out to candidates ahead of the upcoming November election to learn more about where they stand on the issues and what they hope to do for the people of Wisconsin. Today, we'll hear from the two candidates running for U.S. Senate, Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger Eric Hovde, a banking and real estate CEO. In keeping with WUWM's policy on elected officials, these interviews haven't been edited for content. They have been edited for time, but only full questions and answers have been removed. The full interview for both candidates can be found at WUWM.com. We'll start with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin in conversation with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
On paper, the economy is doing well, but there are a lot of people who really aren't feeling the effects. What are you doing right now to address the issue of inflation?
So checks really aren't stretching like they used to, and families are struggling to make ends meet. And one of my priorities in the Senate right now is relieving some of the most pressing financial burdens for families. So healthcare costs are one of the biggest things I hear about, especially those who rely on prescription drugs. And I've been proud of my record to try to make healthcare more affordable, bringing down the price of prescription drugs, including the cost for insulin for seniors and inhalers for people with asthma and COPD. We just had a recent success of bringing down or capping out-of-pocket costs for inhalers to no more than $35 out-of-pocket per inhaler for three out of the four manufacturers of inhalers. Childcare is also a big strain for families. We have childcare deserts where it's almost impossible to find childcare. We also have places where you can find the childcare, but the premiums, the tuition is really, really sky high. I chair a committee, a subcommittee on the Appropriations Committee that is very much focused on these types of programs. I've been able to fight to deliver $122 million for Wisconsin childcare specifically. I know the cost of housing is something that is very burdensome these days, whether that's rent or just being able to find a house that you can buy. Part of the challenge for homeowners is that we have private equity firms and others that are gobbling up all the housing stock, and then they're absentee landlords. But that's taking that housing stock out of the opportunity for home ownership. So I am working on a lead author of the Affordable Housing and Homeownership Protection Act, which would crack down on these hedge funds and private equity firms that are gobbling up this housing stock. And then, you know, the price of groceries, that's probably what people think of. I am pleased the price of gas is going down. That's something that's very top of mind for folks, because every day if you're out driving, you go past a billboard at the gas station saying how much they're charging for gas. I've been happy to see some places where it's under $3 a gallon now. But I think the other thing that really is irksome for families is not seeing their grocery bill go down, even though there's reports that inflation has gone down. And there, I think you have some greed, corporate greed going on. I think you have some price gouging. And I think we have to have a way to go after price gouging. And I've sponsored legislation to that effect.
Yeah, that's a question, though. Can the government realistically hold companies accountable for price gouging? And what would that enforcement actually look like?
So the bill that we have introduced really, first of all, just identifies what agency would be the cop on the beat, if you will. And that's the Federal Trade Commission. They have a lot of other authorities, but one of them is not really investigating price gouging. And frankly, I think if we were to give them those authorities, that there would be, let's say, a little more care taken by the corporations that are price gouging, because they'd know that there would be potentially an investigation, potentially repercussions. But I'll tell you some of the stories that I've heard that are really distressing to me. Let's just take diapers for a young family. You need diapers. When the supply chains were all screwed up during the pandemic, the cost of diapers went way up. Once those supply chains went back to normal, the cost of production for companies that make diapers went down significantly. You know, their biggest input cost is wood pulp, right? Their paper product. And when that plummeted, they did not adjust their prices at all. And so they're making much more dramatic profits now. And families, moms are still paying the same high price. And they're bragging about it in their quarterly reports, their quarterly earnings calls.
Now, abortion is a big issue for voters and one that you believe should be addressed at the federal level instead of the state level. What are you proposing?
I am the lead author of a bill called the Women's Health Protection Act. That measure would codify Roe at the federal level, so that would be the law of the land in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. But also, it takes a further, and I think a very necessary step, telling states like Wisconsin and the ones you've been reading about and hearing about, Texas, Florida, Idaho, that have all passed or have laws at the state level that interfere with the free exercise, the rights and the freedoms embodied in the Roe decision. And so you couldn't go ahead and pass laws at the state level that would be in conflict with Roe. And so I've been fighting to advance the Women's Health Protection Act. I think that is the response that we must pursue to the chaos that we're seeing right now in our state, where I've heard harrowing stories about people bleeding out, people risking their fertility, risking their lives, because that health care is not available in 69 out of our 72 counties.
Do you think you have the votes to make that happen?
I believe that there is a majority in the Senate that is supportive of the Women's Health Protection Act. However, we have this archaic rule in the Senate whereby you have to overcome a filibuster in order to get to that simple majority vote. You need 60 votes to advance the bill. And so I do think that we would need to reform our filibuster rules for important constitutional issues like this one.
Now, you've talked about the need for border security, tightening border security, but many Americans feel like that hasn't happened. What is your plan to address this issue at the border?
Earlier this year, we in the Senate negotiated probably the toughest border legislation that we've had in decades. And it was actually negotiated by one of the most conservative Republicans in the U.S. Senate. We reached an agreement, and then, and let me tell you some of the things in that bill. 1,500 new U.S. Border Patrol agents. The bill was endorsed by the U.S. Border Patrol, a very conservative union. It also had advanced screening technology at the Southwest border to help interdict illegal fentanyl and other illegal drugs coming across that border. It's said that 90% of illicit fentanyl comes through ports of entry at the border. And if we had better screening to be able to look into vehicles, we would be able to interdict a lot more. I kind of liken them to the way we put our bags through screening at the airport. The screening devices can see inside without having to open them. Right now, there's a laborious process of randomly and sometimes not randomly selecting vehicles for full searches, but so many vehicles are going through with no search. If we could stand up this screening equipment and technology, there is so much more we can do. And so I was so disappointed when Republicans reversed course on this strong border bill, really at the urging of Donald Trump, because he would prefer, and many Republicans would prefer, to have the chaos at the border for a political issue for this campaign rather than addressing the problem. I am so frankly angry that that bill was tanked by politics.
That does seem to speak to the issue of partisanship, which has really increased during your time in the Senate. Now, you've been in the Senate for more than a decade, and if elected, this would be your third term. You've been called a career politician, and there are people who believe senators should only serve one or two terms. What can you do with another 6 years in office that you haven't been able to do in the last, you know, in the last terms?
Oh, yes. So first of all, when you serve in the United States Senate, you must work in a bipartisan way. I talked earlier about the filibuster. You need 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. There's not 60 members of either party. So you have to work across the aisle in order to get things done. And I will say, the profound majority of the legislation that I introduce, I'm working with a Republican partner on it because I'm serious about wanting to get things done. I have bills with almost every Republican member of the Senate, and that's the way it should be. And I think those stories often don't get the attention that the polarization and the partisanship gets. So I work with my colleagues every single day. In terms of the areas in which I spend my time focusing on, it includes the issue that motivated me to run for office in the first place, the issue of healthcare, affordable access to high quality healthcare. We have some profound disparities in healthcare access as well as healthcare outcomes in the state of Wisconsin, whether that's access because you live in a rural area and there's not healthcare nearby, or that is disparities sometimes also in our cities. I work to lower the price of prescription drugs, an area that we have just started working in, and we've seen now the first round of negotiations that Medicare has undertaken, leading to the reduction in prices for 10 major medications. But we have to go on to a second round, a third round. We have to hasten the pace of this. And we have to make sure that those lower prices are not just for those on Medicare, but are for everybody. We have to expand the workforce in healthcare. We've seen a lot of attrition with regard to nurses and physicians and other healthcare workers because of, in part because of the pandemic. We have to make sure that we're able to fill those vacancies. And there's lots of people who want to go into those fields, but we have to make that healthcare path affordable to them also. And that's just in, those are, and then we have to continue to focus in on mental health care and substance abuse treatment. Again, an area where there's a lot of workforce vacancies and more demand for those services than there is practitioners to fill those roles. But those are some near and longer term focuses in the healthcare arena. I want to make sure everyone has the opportunity for a great job. I am very proud of the work that I've done with regard to Buy America rules. I've fought to include permanent Buy America rules in most of the major legislation we've passed in recent years, the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Inflation Reduction Act. What it means is that when we're spending taxpayer dollars, we want those dollars supporting U.S. workers and U.S. small businesses. And I'm seeing jobs come back to the U.S. because of those Buy America rules. We saw 200 new jobs in Kenosha to build circuitry for our broadband build out. That's because I had Buy America rules in the infrastructure bill. And the story, the positive stories continue, but we need to do more.
But what do you say to these accusations that career politicians, people who have been politicians like you for most of their lives, shouldn't remain in Congress, that maybe it's time for new blood, somebody who has experience in other arenas?
You know, one thing I would say is that there is something to be said for experience and in a body that also is based in some parts, in some ways on seniority, the opportunities that Wisconsinites have because of my experience. I chair a subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee based on my seniority that funds the Labor Department, the Health and Human Services Department, and the Education Department. I fight for Wisconsin and our education, our Health and Human Services, funding the NIH in that measure every year. Wisconsin gains mightily by my experience and by my seniority just because of that position. And I could say the same about my my other roles. I do think there's something very strong to be said about both experience and seniority.
All right. Well, Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
That was Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin in conversation with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find their full conversation at WUWM.com, as well as on our voter guide for the November 5th election. Later in the show, we'll hear from former Governor Scott Walker as a part of a project we're doing this week that examines North Avenue's importance in the presidential election. But first, we'll hear next from Senator Baldwin's Republican challenger, Eric Hovde. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. WUWM has been reaching out to candidates ahead of the upcoming November election to learn more about where they stand on the issues and what they hope to do for the people of Wisconsin. We just heard from current U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. Now we'll hear from her Republican challenger, Eric Hovde, a banking and real estate CEO. In keeping with WUWM's policy on elected officials, these interviews haven't been edited for content. They have been edited for time, but only full questions and answers have been removed. The full interview for both candidates can be found at WUWM.com. Candidate Hovde joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
We did a call out for people to submit their questions for you, and a lot of people questioned why you, as someone who has spent a lot of time living outside of Wisconsin, is running to represent us here. Why do you believe you're the right person to represent Wisconsin in the Senate when you've chosen to spend so much of your adult life living outside of the state?
I got to laugh at that one, Joy. I don't spend so much of my time living outside the state. That's just the attack ads at Senator Baldwin, and it tells you her truthfulness. I'm a fourth generation Wisconsinite, born here, raised in public schools, graduated from East High in 1982, graduated from the University of Wisconsin in 1986. I moved back to the state in 2011. I live here, I pay my taxes here, I vote here. I've spent probably, I don't know, two-thirds plus of my life in the state of Wisconsin. So it's just a phony claim by the Baldwin campaign. And I frankly think it probably is because she's wanting to deflect from the fact that she takes an enormous amounts of money from places like New York, California, and that she lives primarily in New York with her partner on Wall Street. So I think that's probably why they're launching these attacks. But getting back to why would I get into this race? It's real simple. I love my country, and I'm deeply concerned about the direction of my country. I'm very concerned, if you look at what our founding fathers wanted, they wanted citizen legislators that went and served a term or two to bring their expertise, whether you're a farmer, a doctor, a merchant, business person, to go to Washington, use their expertise to govern this country, and then go back to their communities. Instead, we've developed a political class of career politicians that really have no breadth of knowledge. They don't operate in the real world. They get bought off by special interests, be it Wall Street, be it big tech, big pharma, you name it. And again, they don't really have the expertise to understand the issues. As an example, Senator Baldwin, she's never had to buy herself health insurance because she's worked for the government her whole life. I've not only had to buy myself health insurance, I've had to buy thousands of employees health insurance. And I've had to navigate all the complications and problems with our healthcare system that is in great trouble right now. So housing, we're having a hard time providing affordable housing for our people. And again, how would Senator Baldwin have any clue on how the housing market works, how to make housing less affordable? My real estate company here in Wisconsin, which is the office I'm sitting in today, I understand the complications and the costs that have been put into the system to create affordable housing. So I think getting to the heart of your answer is I bring a wealth of expertise from being in the real world, the private sector, and I want to go serve the country I love. And that's why I'm in this race.
I will clarify that you have lived in Washington, D.C., for example, I believe starting in 1987. You lived there for a couple decades, I believe. Mm-hmm. You've also owned homes around the country, so you have spent a fair amount of your adult life outside of Wisconsin. But
Joy, I didn't know being successful and having somebody, a lot of people in the state of Wisconsin never were raised here, born here, lived here for large portions of their life. Are they not a Wisconsinite if they've lived here now for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years? Or other people that were born, raised, left the state, and then came back, they're no longer Wisconsinites? I just think the framework of your whole argument is rather absurd. I am a Wisconsinite.
Sure. I'm not making an argument.
I'm a fourth generation.
I'm not making an argument to you. I'm asking you a question.
Yeah, and I'm answering your question. I just disagree with the premise of what you're trying to imply with your question. That's what I'm disagreeing with.
Okay. So you've said you believe the government has been spending recklessly and needs to decrease the national debt by returning federal spending to 2019 levels. What programs are you intending to cut to make that happen?
Well, it's very simple. All you do is you pull all government programs back to 19 levels. Again, our population didn't increase by 40%. We increased the spending because during the lockdowns, we were doing transfer payments directly to employees, frankly, every American, as we shut down the economy, and we were transferring support payments to businesses to keep them afloat. But then at the end of 20, as the economy got released and opened back up, and the economy started roaring back as companies got going again and employees got rehired again, we kept spending not only up at that level by 40%, we actually continued to grow it. and continue to spend money very recklessly.
Which programs are you talking about?
What's that?
What programs are you talking about? Where's that money going? Okay, so which programs are you going to cut these funds from?
All federal program spending went up, but the bulk of the increase were on things like the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, which, you know, I don't know why we spent so much money for corporate welfare for big chip makers. That didn't make a lot of sense to me, but that is the heart of why we have inflation. Because what is inflation? Inflation is too much money chasing the same amount of fixed goods and services. That is the essence of inflation. And when you spend that money and you deficit spend at that level, the Federal Reserve, the bank for the federal government, had to buy an enormous amount of that debt through a program called quantitative easing. We can get into that if you want. But
no, so you want to cut money from all programs.
All programs should be pulled back to 2019 levels.
So moving on. Abortion is a big issue for voters. It's something we've gotten a lot of questions about. But it's an issue that you've said can't be addressed by Congress because Democrats and Republicans won't be able to agree. You've said instead the people of Wisconsin should vote on it. But a binding referendum would have to be introduced by Wisconsin's legislature, which is currently controlled by your party. What would that referendum realistically look like? And what are you doing to advocate for an abortion question going to voters?
First of all, I'm running for the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. So I do not believe, as it pertains to the U.S. Senate, and Senator Baldwin's running ads that I want to put in place an abortion ban. I do not support that. Let me be very clear. I do not support that. I believe it's been sent back to the states where different states are resolving this. Most states, probably 30 plus of our 50 states, have resolved this issue. I think we need to take a common sense, compassionate approach. I believe in the beauty of life. I have two daughters, three grandchildren, and I agree with exceptions for rape, incest, and the health of the mother. And I believe women early on in their pregnancy should have a right to choose. I just have a difference of opinion that when a baby can be born healthy and alive, that it's unconscionable to terminate that baby's life. Now, as it pertains to the state, I'm not a state legislator. It's up to the legislative body to resolve this issue working with the governor. Right now in the state, we have, 20 weeks?
But to clarify, you're not doing anything to advocate for this question going to voters.
No, I think I've said
that's
very
not
clear.
Your responsibility.
I do advocate. I hope the governor and the state legislative body come up with a proposal. I would love
sure.
to see that.
A hope isn't an advocate, though. You're not advocating.
Joy,
what are you doing?
I love how you frame that. I just got finished saying.
Yeah.
I just got finished saying I advocate for the state legislative body and the governor to come together and put forth a proposal. That's all I can do. I am a private citizen just like you. So I advocate for them to come up with a proposal.
So border security has been a top issue for you and many Republicans, with former President Trump vowing to enact the largest deportation effort in U.S. history. But industries like dairy farming in Wisconsin rely on immigrant workers. Do you agree with Trump's mass deportation proposal, and how do you intend to help businesses that currently rely on migrant work?
Well, from the day one, I have said not only do we need to close our border because of the humanitarian crisis they've created, the fentanyl crisis that they've created, the modern-day slavery that they've created in our country, and a whole raft of issues, but I've also said from day one, we have to fix our legal immigration process. And we have a broken legal immigration process. And I think we have to get that fixed quickly. I think anybody that's applying should be given a thumbs up or thumbs down within a reasonable period of time, is that 3, 4, 5 years, whether they have a chance to come into our country, yes or no. If they are given, because they're you know, they go through a background check, everything checks out. They look like they would be somebody that we would like in our country. Then I think we have to go through, here are the steps that you can come. A lot of countries around the world, like Canada, have a point system. So as an example, we have a shortage of doctors and nurses in our country. And so maybe you get more points if you have a nursing degree or a doctor's degree. Because, as I said, we have a shortage. But I strongly believe we need to fix our legal immigration system and work permit program. Because not everybody that comes into our country wants to stay here permanently. A lot of people come here to work. They send their money back to whatever country. It could be Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, you name it. And they want to go back, but they want to come and work for 6 months or 8 months out of the year. So I'm a strong advocate of fixing our legal immigration system.
It sounds like you might support a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, but am I reading that wrong?
We have to go through a process. If you have come in this country illegally, I think you have to go back and enter in through a legal process. I think that's a very important distinction, because what you have is you have many people that have wanted to come into this country, have abided by the rules, and they're not, you know, being penalized if other people are put ahead of them who came in here illegally. But look, I would love to see us resolve this on both sides. I do know that our open border has caused enormous difficulties and problems in our country on multiple different levels. And as I said, they've created a humanitarian crisis, which I'm deeply concerned about. I've been fighting against sex trafficking in this country and around the world for, 20 years. I've had a partnership with Thorn. I funded something called Spotlight that law enforcement uses, because most people and underage people are trafficked over the internet. And they can't account for 100,000 children. And sadly, I can say probably a large percentage of those children have ended up in the sex trade today. So I have very strong feelings that we've got to fix both sides of this fence, legal immigration, and close the border to stop illegal immigration.
Now, you just published an opinion piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about gun control, and you really focused on not gun laws necessarily, but instead mental health. Now, people need to be able to afford access to mental health care, of course. You've mentioned the high cost of health care in general. What is your plan to ensure that people can access mental health care?
You know, that's of all these expenditures of the federal government that I would be supportive of seeing an increase in spending is mental health. We have a real mental health crisis in our country at multiple levels. A lot will tell you that it's particularly for young people tied directly into social media. In fact, there's been multiple different studies by different universities that show since the advent of social media, mental health crises have risen dramatically in our country. So I am very concerned, because if you look at, you know, mass gun violence, and there's a pattern, unfortunately, in our country today when you have mass shootings, and it's often a younger person, a man, a male most of the times, the vast majority of the times, isolated, having mental health problems, spending an inordinate amount of time playing hyper-violent video games. Our entertainment is saturated with violence today in this country, which I think is very unfortunate. I'd like to get at the root cause, because, you know, a gun is an instrument, no different than a car, no different than anything. And as my article, you know, talked about, if you want to do damage and harm, there's a lot of ways you can, do that. You know, I mentioned the Christmas parade killing, where a person drove through the Christmas parade and killed a number of people. But probably the biggest incident of that was Oklahoma City, our second largest terrorist incident in our country's history, where two troubled youth filled up a van with fertilizer, drove it into a federal government building in Oklahoma City, and blew it up and killed 287 people. And there was actually a daycare center in there, so a number of children died as well. So if you intend to do a harm and kill people, there's a lot of ways to do it. So I think we really just have to get to the root cause of the issue.
That was Wisconsin's Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, Eric Hovde, speaking with Like Effect's Joy Powers. You can hear Joy's full conversation with Eric Hovde and Senator Tammy Baldwin at wuwm.com/voterguide. There you can learn about the other candidates that you'll see on your ballot, the ballot measures, and how to vote. We'll take one more break and then continue our series where we explore how North Avenue, which stretches from Milwaukee's east side into Waukesha County, represents different political and economic outlooks here in Wisconsin. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This week, WUWM's Mayan Silver is delving into Milwaukee's North Avenue and what it can tell us about politics ahead of the presidential election. Yesterday, we heard from Democratic strategist Thad Nation, who said North Avenue reflects key voting groups important for either party to win the election. Today, we get the conservative perspective from someone also well acquainted with the area, former Governor Scott Walker. Before he became governor, he was a state representative based in Wauwatosa, one of the communities along North Avenue. Walker is now president of Young America's Foundation, a nonprofit mobilizing young conservatives. WUWM's Mayan Silver is joined by Walker for his perspective on the political importance of North Avenue.
North Avenue sweeps through a whole bunch of city neighborhoods and Milwaukee's inner and outer suburbs. So I was wondering, former Governor Walker, as a politician and strategist, do you feel like North Avenue has a political importance? And if so, what would it be?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a great connector. You get it connecting to very different demographics, very different economics, very different politics. But politically, you know, it's one of those areas, one of those key corridors that connects, you know, Lake Michigan all the way out to the Waukesha suburbs and kind of everywhere in between. And so over the years, in our case, personally, it was very important. We raised our sons, Matt and Alex, in Wauwatosa, just a few houses. We could literally walk out our front door and see North Avenue in Wauwatosa at 73rd and North, where there was a car wash three houses down the block from us. So for us, a lot of memories there. But we know my brother and his wife and their family lives just down the way from North Avenue at the far west end. So a lot of personal connections for me, as well as politically. You know, you go from east to west or west to east, and the politics shift as it's a fairly reflective, I think, in many ways of the political spectrum that you have in the state of Wisconsin.
And of course, you were serving in the assembly before you became Wisconsin governor, and it was a Republican, predominantly Republican area in Wauwatosa and then western Waukesha County. But then it's sort of shifted over the years, and now I think Wauwatosa is like maybe, I think it was like 66% for Biden in 2020, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, very much like Shorewood. We kind of saw that trend where you've had, I think over the years, we saw it in Shorewood of folks who, in many cases, lived or worked on the UWM campus. They wanted to live close to where they worked, but didn't want kids going to MPS, but rather preferred their kids to go to Shorewood, which was early on perceived as a very good school district. I think you see similarities of folks now with folks who worked not at a college or university, but teachers, MPS, workers in the city of Milwaukee, others now wanting to move a little bit further west to be a part of the Wauwatosa School District. But in turn, you start to see a shift in the politics, much as you saw years ago in Sherwood. Interestingly enough, you know, Wauwatosa was more was considered to be more Republican decades and decades ago. Even before I was there, it was starting to shift when I was in. And West Allis was considered to be more of a union, blue-collar city. And the irony is West Allis has become probably more conservative, while Wauwatosa has become more liberal. And it's interesting to see it go from, you know, blue-collar, white-collar, and the shift that we see in the state is somewhat that we see across the country as well.
Democratic strategist Thad Nation, he is asserting that as goes North Avenue, so goes Wisconsin. He said if Democrats see African-American turnout high throughout maybe the 18, 19 neighborhoods that North Avenue runs through in the city of Milwaukee, if they see the inner suburban ring that we were just talking about, Wauwatosa voting for the Democrats, and the outer suburban ring performing at about 45-46%, which he says is what they've seen in recent years, in statewide races. And then also you've got the very blue voters on the east side of Milwaukee that are one of the most high turnout areas in the state, according to Nation. Do you agree that if Democrats can play well with all those kind of groups, then they're in good shape?
No, I think that's a pretty accurate description in terms of just because you got such a high population base in southeastern Wisconsin, but particularly along this corridor. And so for a Republican to do well, they've got to do well in the suburbs. So in the far end of West or the far west end of North Avenue, they've got to, you know, stay within reasonable amounts within the Milwaukee County suburbs and then not get blown away in the city of Milwaukee. Part of that is you've got the east side, which is very much like Madison, solidly blue, but not just blue, but liberal, you know, Bernie Sanders level liberal. One of the key factors be not just turnout in the city of Milwaukee, but what sort of an impact does the economy and education issues have on those voters? And could a Republican, be they running for president or U.S. Senate, make any inroads to at least shave a little bit? They're not realistically going to get anywhere close to a majority, but if you can shave the margins down a little bit, that has a could have a tremendous impact on the overall state result.
What should Republicans be doing to connect with voters in the areas, like we're talking the western and easternmost ends, like helping curb the margins on the far east side of Milwaukee, connecting with black voters, upping the margins in, you know, Waukesha County where there've been some slippage? What do you think Republicans should be doing?
Talking about high prices, not just the economy in general, but about high prices. That to me is the most compelling argument. Donald Trump can without hesitation say life was better, prices were lower, people were bringing more home, more take-home pay and keeping more of their pay. And when he was president, the last 3.5 years, there's been a major shift. Prices for food, for gas, for housing, for rent, for mortgages, all of those things have gone up dramatically since Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were in office. And if I was him, if I was speaking on his behalf, I'd say life was better when I was in office. The cost of living has gone up to the point of almost being out of control for most people in this area and throughout Wisconsin, across the country. And say, my opponent says she's going to lower prices in day one, but day one for her started on January 20th, 2021. And, you know, she hasn't done it. So why do you have any belief that if she and Joe Biden haven't gotten it done over the last 3.5 years, why would anyone believe it'll be any different, if not worse, if we give them 4 more years? And to me, if that's the argument, if that's the point, I think you not only see the numbers in the far west end going into Waukesha County going up, I think you start to see even some independent voters throughout that quarter start to think twice about who they're going to vote for.
But when you were first describing North Avenue, you were talking about, you know, the wide kind of seesaw of economic situation that you see when you drive either from west to east or east to west, and you go through the area. I mean, Bronzeville is like third to 12th. It's kind of doing better. There's a GOP outreach office there. There are businesses in that area that are doing well economically, but you've got a stretch of North Avenue from like 12th all the way out to like 40s in the 40s before you get to Sherman Park, where there's, you know, there are boarded up houses, there are boarded up businesses, there are dilapidated porches, not a lot of economic activity as much as in other areas. And it's predominantly Black neighborhoods. Democratic strategist Thad Nation said that he thinks the GOP outreach to Milwaukee's Black voters is, quote, a lot of noise over substance because he doesn't see them in the community. What do you say about that?
One, I think there actually is a rich and vibrant outreach, but I think one of the unique things about Donald Trump, which many in the national media initially kind of dismissed, but is he's much more aggressive just personally, publicly, repeatedly, not just doing targeted outreach that's been done in the past by many Republicans, but actually flat out just says, what do you got to lose? You know, you've had Democrats making promises in big cities like Milwaukee for decades, and they failed to deliver. You don't see your neighborhoods getting any better. You're seeing prices going up. The chances slipping away. And he said, give me a chance. Black unemployment in America was the lowest it has ever been when he was president years ago. And I think he makes not just a compelling case, but he's made a persistent case to Black voters and to other voters who maybe historically haven't been courted well enough by Republican candidates. And it's, again, it's one of those where his key to success is just not backing off of that, of continuing to push that theme over and over and over again. And it doesn't have to be a targeted message. It's a message that's compelling, you know, in the heart of the city of Milwaukee, as it is in Wauwatosa, as it might be out in Pewaukee or Brookfield, because everyone's living a life full of much higher prices on essentials like food, gas, and housing compared to where we were just a few years ago.
And, you know, switching back to the west side of North Avenue, where you've got Brookfield, and Waukesha is kind of the heart of the Republican Party, you could say, even in the state. I mean, rural areas are very red, but you've got Waukesha. Why is Waukesha basically a ground zone for Republicans in Wisconsin?
Well, population base. I mean, you got to keep your margins within reasonable levels in Milwaukee. That's by far the largest county. But in terms of a county where Republicans are winning, Waukesha is not only a large county in its own right, but it's one where historically Republicans have played well. And the key is just trying to push those margins up as high as possible. So it's not only taking in existing voters, but there's a lot of efforts to identify and register new voters, figuring that, you know, for every 10 voters in Waukesha County, if you pick six or seven of them vote Republican, that helps drive up those margins.
And do you think, if you could just weigh in real briefly on suburban women and trending away from Donald Trump, perhaps because of personality issues or certain policies or things like that, what do Republicans have to do to get back voters that they've most recently lost?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. The research we've seen tells us, not inconsistent with the rest of the country, it's tone. It's not substance. It's not the policies. Voters overwhelmingly in the WOW counties are with Republicans on the issues. And they were a little uncomfortable in 16 on tone and personality. They were very much so in 2020. Donald Trump, I think, has got to be candid with voters, particularly with suburban voters, and just say, hey, you may not like everything about me. You may not like my post on social media. You may not like some of the things I say. But in the end, your family was much better off when I was president than they are right now. And if you want to get life back on the right track, then I ask for your vote. That should be his key argument. If he's effective at that, he can win back similar margins, what they've seen in the past. If he gets caught up in other battles, it becomes much more difficult.
So you think this is, again, North Avenue corridor, one to watch, covers a lot of different groups that may or may not sway the election in Wisconsin in 2024?
I think there's no doubt that North Avenue is a corridor to watch. And a lot of it will be not only just who wins the majority of votes in certain parts of North Avenue, but what the margins are, not only running the margins up in areas that are favorable to the one candidate versus another, but also keeping the margins in the other parts that aren't as favorable reasonable and within reach.
All right. Scott Walker, former governor and current president of Young America's Foundation, thanks for speaking with me on Lake Effect about North Avenue.
My pleasure.
That was former Republican Governor Scott Walker talking with WUWM's Mayon Silver for her series about Wisconsin politics as seen from North Avenue. Tomorrow, we'll hear about demographic trends on North Avenue from Marquette Research Fellow John Johnson. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you listen to podcasts to hear all of our shows on demand. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear how FAFSA delays impacted local students. Plus, we'll tell you all about the Milwaukee Comedy Festival. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.